along with a series of administrative access codes and system exploits that could give a user carte blanche inside the company network. I would have assumed the data was bogus had it not been listed on such a respected site. The anonymous seller claimed to be a former IOI contract programmer and one of the lead architects of its company intranet. He was probably a turncoat, a programmer who intentionally coded back doors and security holes into a system he designed so that he could later sell them on the black market. It allowed him to get paid for the same job twice and to salve any guilt he felt about working for a demonic multinational corporation like IOI. The obvious problem, which the seller didn't bother to point out in the auction listing, was that these codes were useless unless you already had access to the company intranet. IOI's intranet was a high-security, standalone network with no direct connections to the OASIS. The only way to get access to IOI's intranet was to become one of their legitimate employees, very difficult and time-consuming. Or you could join the company's ever-growing ranks of indentured servants. I'd decided to bid on the IOI access codes anyway, on the off chance they might come in handy someday. Since there was no way to verify the data's authenticity, the bidding stayed low, and I won the auction for a few thousand credits. The codes arrived in my inbox a few minutes after the auction ended. Once I'd finished decrypting the data, I examined it all thoroughly. Everything looked legit, so I filed the info away for a rainy day and forgot about it, until about 6 months later, when I saw the Sixer barricade around Castle Anorak. The first thing I thought of was the IOI access codes. Then the wheels in my head began to turn, and my ridiculous plan began to take shape. I would alter the financial records on my bogus Bryce Lynch identity and allow myself to become indentured by IOI. Once I infiltrated the building and got behind the company firewall, I would use the intranet passwords to hack into the Sixers' private database, then figure a way to bring down the shield they'd erected over Anorak's castle. I didn't think anyone would anticipate this move because it was so clearly insane. I didn't test the IOI passwords until the second night of my indenturement. I was understandably anxious, because if it turned out I'd been sold bogus data and none of the passwords worked, I would have sold myself into lifelong slavery. Keeping my ear gear camera pointed straight ahead, away from the screen, I pulled up the entertainment console's viewer settings menu, which allowed me to make adjustments to the display's audio and video output, volume and balance, brightness and tint. I cranked each option up to its highest setting, then tapped the Apply button at the bottom of the screen three times. I set the volume and brightness controls to their lowest settings and tapped the Apply button again. A small window appeared in the center of the screen, prompting me for a maintenance tech ID number and access password. I quickly entered the ID number and the long alphanumeric password that I'd memorized. I checked both for errors out of the corner of my eye, then tapped OK. The system paused for what seemed like a very long time. Then, to my great relief, the following message appeared. Maintenance control panel. Access granted. I now had access to a maintenance service account designed to allow repairmen to test and debug the entertainment unit's various components. I was now logged in as a technician, but my access to the intranet was still pretty limited. Still, it gave me all the elbow room I needed. Using an exploit left by one of the programmers, I was now able to create a bogus admin account. Once that was set up, I had access to just about everything. My first order of business was to get some privacy. I quickly navigated through several dozen submenus until I reached the control panel for the indent monitoring system. When I entered my employee number, my indent profile appeared on the display, along with a mugshot they'd taken of me during my initial processing. The profile listed my indent account balance, pay grade, blood type, current performance review rating, every scrap of data the company had on me. At the top right of my profile were two VidFeed windows, one fed by the camera in my ear gear, the other linked to the camera in my HAB unit. My ear gear VidFeed was currently aimed at a section of the wall. The HAB unit camera window showed a view of the back of my head, which I'd positioned to block the entertainment center's display screen. I selected both VidFeed cameras and accessed their configuration settings. Using one of the Turncoat's exploits, I performed a quick hack that caused my ear gear and HAB unit cameras to display the archived video from my first night of indenturement instead of a live feed. Now, if someone checked my camera feeds, they'd see me lying asleep in my HAB unit, not sitting up all night, furiously hacking my way through the company intranet. Then I programmed the cameras to switch to the pre-recorded feeds whenever I shut out the lights in my HAB unit. The split-second jump cut in the feed would be masked by the momentary video distortion that occurred when the cameras switched into night vision mode. I kept expecting to be discovered and locked out of the system, but it never happened. My passwords continued to work. I'd spent the past 6 nights laying siege to the IOI intranet, digging deeper and deeper into the network. I felt like a convict in an old prison movie, returning to my cell each night to tunnel through the wall with a teaspoon. Then, last night, just before I'd succumbed to exhaustion, I'd finally managed to navigate my way through the intranet's labyrinth of firewalls and into the main Oology Division database, the motherlode, the Sixers' private file pile. And tonight, I would finally be able to explore it. I knew that I needed to be able to take some of the Sixers' data with me when I escaped. So earlier in the week, I'd used my intranet admin account to submit a bogus hardware requisition form. I had a 10 zettabyte flash drive delivered to a non-existent employee, Sam Lowry, in an empty cubicle a few rows away from my own. Making sure to keep my ear gear camera pointed in the other direction, I ducked into the cube, grabbed the tiny drive, pocketed it, and smuggled it back to my HAB unit. That night, after I shut off the lights and disabled the security cameras, I unlocked my entertainment unit's maintenance access panel and installed the flash drive into an expansion slot used for firmware upgrades. Now, I could download data from the intranet directly to that drive. I put on the entertainment center's visor and gloves, then stretched out on my mattress. The visor presented me with a three-dimensional view of the Sixers database, with dozens of overlapping data windows suspended in front of me. Using my gloves, I began to manipulate these windows, navigating my way through the database's file structure. The largest section of the database appeared to be devoted to information on Halliday. The amount of data they had on him was staggering. It made my Grail diary look like a set of Cliff's Notes. They had things I'd never seen, things I didn't even know existed. Halliday's grade school report cards, home movies from his childhood, emails he'd written to fans. I didn't have time to read over it all, but I copied the really interesting stuff over to my flash drive to hopefully study later. I focused on isolating the data related to Castle Anorak and the forces the Sixers had positioned in and around it. I copied all of the intel on their weapons, vehicles, gunships, and troop numbers. I also snagged all of the data I could find on the Orb of Ozyvox, the artifact they were using to generate the shield around the castle, including exactly where they were keeping it and the employee number of the Sixer wizard they had operating it. Then, I hit the jackpot. A folder containing hundreds of hours of Oasis SimCap recordings documenting the Sixers' initial discovery of the third gate and their subsequent attempts to open it. As everyone now suspected, the third gate was located inside Castle Anorak. Only avatars who possessed a copy of the Crystal Key could cross the threshold of the castle's front entrance. To my disgust, I learned that Sorrento had been the first avatar to set foot inside Castle Anorak since Halliday's death. The castle entrance led into a massive foyer whose walls, floor, and ceiling were all made of gold. At the north end of the chamber, a large crystal door was set into the wall. It had a small keyhole at its very center. The moment I saw it, I knew I was looking at the third gate. I fast-forwarded through several other recent SimCap files. From what I could tell, the Sixers still hadn't figured out how to open the gate. Simply inserting the crystal key into the keyhole had no effect. They'd had their entire team trying to figure out why for several days now, but still hadn't made any progress. While the data and video on the third gate was copying over to my flash drive, I continued to delve deeper into the Sixer database. Eventually, I uncovered a restricted area called the Star Chamber. It was the only area of the database I couldn't seem to access. So I used my admin ID to create a new test account, then gave that account super user access and full administrator privileges. It worked, and I was granted access. The information inside the restricted area was divided into two folders, mission status and threat assessments. I opened the threat assessments folder first, and when I saw what was inside, I felt the blood drain from my face. There were five file folders, labeled Parzival, Artemis, H, Shoto, and Daito. Daito's folder had a large red X over it. I opened the Parzival folder first. A detailed dossier appeared, containing all of the information the Sixers had collected on me over the past few years. My birth certificate, my school transcripts. At the bottom, there was a link to a SimCap of my entire chat link session with Sorrento, ending with the bomb detonating in my aunt's trailer. After I'd gone into hiding, they'd lost track of me. They had collected thousands of screenshots and vidcaps of my avatar over the past year, and loads of data on my stronghold on Falco, but they didn't know anything about my location in the real world. My current whereabouts were listed as unknown. I closed the window, took a deep breath, and opened the file on Artemis. At the very top was a school photo of a young girl with a distinctly sad smile. To my surprise, she looked almost identical to her avatar. The same dark hair, the same hazel eyes, and the same beautiful face I knew so well, with one small difference. Most of the left half of her face was covered with a reddish-purple birthmark. I would later learn that these types of birthmark were sometimes referred to as port wine stains. In the photo, she wore a sweep of her dark hair down over her left eye to try to conceal the mark as much as possible. Artemis had led me to believe that in reality she was somehow hideous, but now I saw that nothing could have been further from the truth. To my eyes, the birthmark did absolutely nothing to diminish her beauty. If anything, the face I saw in the photo seemed even more beautiful to me than that of her avatar, because I knew this one was real. The data below the photo said that her real name was Samantha Evelyn Cook, that she was a 20-year-old Canadian citizen, 5 feet and 7 inches tall, and that she weighed 168 pounds. The file also contained her home address, 2206 Greenleaf Lane, Vancouver, British Columbia, along with a lot of other information, including her blood type and her school transcripts going all the way back to kindergarten. I found an unlabeled video link at the bottom of her dossier, and when I selected it, a live vid feed of a small suburban house appeared on my display. After a few seconds, I realized I was looking at the house where Artemis lived. As I dug further into her file, I learned that they'd had her under surveillance for the past 5 months. They had her house bugged, too, because I found hundreds of hours of audio recordings made while she was logged into the Oasis. They had complete text transcripts of every audible word she'd spoken while clearing the first two gates. I opened Shoto's file next. They knew his real name, Akahide Karatsu, and they also appeared to have his home address an apartment building in Osaka, Japan. His file also contained a school photo, showing a thin, stoic boy with a shaved head. Like Daito, he looked nothing like his avatar. H seemed to be the one they knew the least about. His file contained very little information and no photo, just a screenshot of his avatar. His real name was listed as Henry Swanson, but that was an alias used by Jack Burton in Big Trouble in Little China, so I knew it must be a fake. His address was listed as mobile, and below it there was a link labeled Recent Access Points. This turned out to be a list of the wireless node locations H had recently used to access his Oasis account. They were all over the place. Boston, Washington, D.C., New York City, Philadelphia, and most recently, Pittsburgh. Now I began to understand how the Sixers had been able to locate Artemis and Shoto. IOI owned hundreds of regional telecom companies, effectively making them the largest internet service provider in the world. It was pretty difficult to get online without using a network they owned and operated. From the looks of it, IOI had been illegally eavesdropping on most of the world's internet traffic in an attempt to locate and identify the handful of Gunters they considered to be a threat. The only reason they hadn't been able to locate me was because I'd taken the paranoia-induced precaution of leasing a direct fiber-optic connection to the Oasis from my apartment complex. I closed H's file, then opened the folder labeled Daito, already dreading what I might find there. Like the others, they had his real name, Toshiro Yoshiaki, and his home address. Two news articles about his suicide were linked at the bottom of his dossier, along with an unlabeled video clip time-stamped on the day he'd died. I clicked on it. It was handheld video camera footage showing three large men in black ski masks, one of whom was operating the camera, waiting silently in a hallway. They appeared to receive an order via their radio earpieces, then used a key card to open the door of a tiny one-room apartment, Daito's apartment. I watched in horror as they rushed in, yanked him out of his haptic chair, and threw him off the balcony. The bastards even filmed him plummeting to his death, probably at Sorrento's request. A wave of nausea washed over me. When it finally passed, I copied the contents of all five dossiers over to my flash drive, then opened the Mission Status folder. It appeared to contain an archive of the Oology Division's status reports, intended for the Sixers' top brass. The reports were arranged by date, with the most recent one listed first. When I opened it, I saw that it was a directive memo sent from Nolan Sorrento to the IOI Board of Executives. In it, Sorrento proposed sending agents to abduct Artemis and Shoto from their homes to force them to help IOI open the third gate. Once the Sixers had obtained the egg and won the contest, Artemis and Shoto would be disposed of. I sat there in stunned silence. Then I read the memo again, feeling a combination of rage and panic. According to the timestamp, Sorrento had sent the memo just after 8 o'clock, less than 5 hours ago, so his superiors probably hadn't even seen it yet. When they did, they would still want to meet to discuss Sorrento's suggested course of action, so they probably wouldn't send their agents after Artemis and Shoto until sometime tomorrow. I still had time to warn them, but to do that, I would have to drastically alter my escape plan. Before my arrest, I'd set up a timed funds transfer that would deposit enough money in my IOI credit account to pay off my entire debt, forcing IOI to release me from indenturement. But that transfer wouldn't happen for another 5 days. By then, the Sixers would probably have Artemis and Shoto locked in a windowless room somewhere. I couldn't spend the rest of the week exploring the Sixer database like I'd planned. I had to grab as much data as I could and make my escape now. I gave myself until dawn. Chapter 31. I worked frantically for the next 4 hours. Most of that time was spent copying as much data as possible from the Sixer database to my stolen flash drive. Once that task was completed, I submitted an executive oologist supply requisition order. This was an online form that Sixer commanders used to request weapons or equipment inside the Oasis. I selected a very specific item, then scheduled its delivery for noon 2 days from now. When I finally finished, it was 6:30 in the morning. The next tech support shift change was now only 90 minutes away, and my HAB unit neighbors would start waking up soon. I was out of time. I pulled up my indenturement profile, accessed my debt statement, and zeroed out my outstanding balance, money I'd never actually borrowed to begin with. Then, I selected the Indentured Servant Observation and Communications Tag Control Settings submenu, which operated both my ear gear and security anklet. Finally, I did something I'd been dying to do for the past week. I disabled the locking mechanisms on both devices. I felt a sharp pain as the ear gear clamps retracted and pulled free of the cartilage on my left ear. The device bounced off my shoulder and landed in my lap. In the same instant, the shackle on my right ankle clicked open and fell off, revealing a band of a braided red skin. I'd now passed the point of no return. IOI security techs weren't the only ones who had access to my ear gear's vid feed. The Indentured Servant Protection Agency also used it to monitor and record my daily activities to ensure that my human rights were being observed. Now that I'd removed the device, there would be no digital record of what happened to me from this moment forward. If IOI security caught me before I made it out of the building carrying a stolen flash drive filled with highly incriminating company data, I was dead. The Sixers could torture and kill me, and no one would ever know. I performed a few final tasks related to my escape plan, then logged out of the IOI intranet for the last time. I pulled off my visor and gloves and opened the maintenance access panel next to the entertainment center console. There was a small empty space below the entertainment module between the prefab wall of my HAB unit and the one adjacent to it. I removed the thin, neatly folded bundle I'd hidden there. It was a vacuum-sealed IOI maintenance tech uniform, complete with a cap and an ID badge. Like the flash drive, I'd obtained these items by submitting an intranet requisition form, then had them delivered to an empty cubicle on my floor. I pulled off my indent jumpsuit and used it to wipe the blood off my ear and neck. Then I removed two band-aids from under my mattress and slapped them over the holes in my earlobe. Once I was dressed in my new maintenance tech threads, I carefully removed the flash drive from its expansion slot and pocketed it. Then, I picked up my ear gear and spoke into it. "I need to use the bathroom," I said. The HAB unit door irised open at my feet. The hallway was dark and deserted. I stuffed my ear gear and indent jumpsuit under the mattress and put the anklet in the pocket of my new uniform. Then, reminding myself to breathe, I crawled outside and descended the ladder. I passed a few other indents on my way to the elevators, but as usual, none of them made eye contact. This was a huge relief, because I was worried someone might recognize me and notice that I didn't belong in a maintenance tech uniform. When I stepped in front of the express elevator door, I held my breath as the system scanned my maintenance tech ID badge. After what felt like an eternity, the doors slid open.
"Good morning, Mr. Tuttle," the elevator said as I stepped inside. "Floor, please."
"Lobby," I said hoarsely, and the elevator began to descend. Harry Tuttle was the name printed on my maintenance tech ID badge. I'd given the fictional Mr. Tuttle complete access to the entire building, then reprogrammed my indent anklet so that it was encoded with the Tuttle ID, making it function just like one of the security bracelets that maintenance techs wore.
When the doors and elevators scanned me to make sure I had the proper security clearance, the anklet in my pocket told them that yes, I sure did, instead of doing what it was supposed to do, which was zap my ass with a few thousand volts and incapacitate me until the security guards arrived. I rode the elevator down in silence, trying not to stare at the camera mounted above the doors. Then I realized the video being shot of me would be scrutinized when this was all over. Sorrento himself would probably see it, and so would his superiors. So I looked directly into the lens of the camera, smiled, and scratched the bridge of my nose with my middle finger. The elevator reached the lobby and the doors slid open. I half expected to find an army of security guards waiting for me outside, their guns leveled at my face, but there was only a crowd of IOI middle management drones waiting to get on the elevator. I stared at them blankly for a second, then stepped out of the car. It was like crossing the border into another country. A steady stream of over-caffeinated office workers scurried across the lobby and in and out of the elevators and exits. These were regular employees, not indents. They were allowed to go home at the end of their shifts. They could even quit if they wanted to. I wondered if it bothered any of them, knowing that thousands of indentured slaves lived and toiled here in the same building, just a few floors away from them. I spotted two security guards stationed near the reception desk and gave them a wide berth, weaving my way through the thick crowd, crossing the immense lobby to the long row of automatic glass doors that led outside to freedom. I forced myself not to run as I pushed through the arriving workers. "Just maintenance tech here, folks. Heading home after a long night of rebooting routers. That's all. I am definitely not an indent making a daring escape with 10 zettabytes of stolen company data in his pocket. No siree." Halfway to the doors, I noticed an odd sound and glanced down at my feet. I was still wearing my disposable plastic indent slippers. Each footfall made a shrill squeak on the waxed marble floor, standing out amid the rumble of sensible business footwear. Every step I took seemed to scream, "Hey, look! Over here! A guy in the plastic slippers!" But I kept walking. I was almost to the doors when someone placed a hand on my shoulder. I froze. "Sir," I heard someone say. It was a woman's voice. I almost bolted out the door, but something about the woman's tone stopped me. I turned and saw the concerned face of a tall woman in her mid-40s, dark blue business suit, briefcase. "Sir, your ear is bleeding," she pointed at it, wincing. "A lot." I reached up and touched my earlobe, and my hand came away red. At some point, the band-aids I'd applied had fallen off. I was paralyzed for a second, unsure of what to do. I wanted to give her an explanation, but couldn't think of one. So I simply nodded, muttered thanks, then turned around and, as calmly as possible, walked outside. The frozen morning wind was so fierce that it nearly knocked me over. When I regained my balance, I bounded down the tiered steps, pausing briefly to drop my anklet into a trash receptacle. I heard it hit the bottom with a satisfying thud. Once I reached the street, I headed north, walking as fast as my feet would carry me. I was somewhat conspicuous because I was the only person not wearing a coat of some kind. My feet quickly went numb because I also wasn't wearing socks under my plastic indent slippers. My entire body was shivering by the time I finally reached the warm confines of the mailbox, a post office box rental outlet located 4 blocks from the IOI Plaza. The week before my arrest, I'd rented a post office box here online and had a top-of-the-line portable Oasis rig shipped to it. The mailbox was completely automated, so there were no employees to contend with, and when I walked in, there were no customers either. I located my box, punched in the key code, and retrieved the portable Oasis rig. I sat down on the floor and ripped open the package right there. I rubbed my frozen hands together until the feeling returned to my fingers, then put on the gloves and visor and used the rig to log into the Oasis. Gregarious Simulation Systems was located less than a mile away, so I was able to use one of their complementary wireless access points instead of one of the city nodes owned by IOI. My heart was pounding as I logged in. I'd been offline for 8 whole days, a personal record. As my avatar slowly materialized on my stronghold's observation deck, I looked down at my virtual body, admiring it like a favorite suit I hadn't worn in a while. A window immediately appeared on my display, informing me that I'd received several messages from H and Shoto. And, to my surprise, there was even a message from Artemis. All three of them wanted to know where I was and what the hell had happened to me. I replied to Artemis first. I told her that the Sixers knew who she was and where she lived, and that they had her under constant surveillance. I also warned her about their plans to abduct her from her home. I pulled a copy of her dossier off the flash drive and attached it to my message as proof. Then, I politely suggested that she leave home immediately and get the hell out of Dodge. "Don't stop to pack a suitcase," I wrote. "Don't say goodbye to anyone. Leave right now and get somewhere safe. Make sure you aren't followed. Then, find a secure, non-IOI-controlled internet connection and get back online. I'll meet you in H's basement as soon as I can. Don't worry, I have some good news, too." At the bottom of the message, I added a short postscript. "P.S. I think you look even more beautiful in real life." I sent similar emails to Shoto and H, minus the postscript, along with copies of their Sixer dossiers. Then, I pulled up the United States Citizen Registry database and attempted to log in. To my great relief, the passwords I'd purchased still worked, and I was able to access the fake Bryce Lynch citizen profile I'd created. It now contained the ID photo taken during my indent processing, and the words "wanted fugitive" were superimposed over my face. IOI had already reported Mr. Lynch as an escaped indent. It didn't take me very long to completely erase the Bryce Lynch identity and copy my fingerprints and retinal patterns back over to my original citizen profile. When I logged out of the database a few minutes later, Bryce Lynch no longer existed. I was Wade Watts once again. I hailed an auto cab outside the mailbox, making sure to select one operated by a local cab company and not a Supra cab, which was a wholly owned subsidiary of IOI. When I got in, I held my breath as I pressed my thumb to the ID scanner. The display flashed green. The system recognized me as Wade Watts, not as the fugitive indent, Bryce Lynch.
"Good morning, Mr. Watts," the auto cab said. "Where to?"
I gave the cab the address of a clothing store on High Street, close to the OSU campus. It was a place called Threads, which specialized in high-tech urban streetwear. I ran inside and bought a pair of jeans and a sweater. Both items were dichotomy wear, meaning they were wired for Oasis use. They didn't have haptics, but the pants and shirt could link up with my portable immersion rig, letting it know what I was doing with my torso, arms, and legs, making it easier to control my avatar than with a gloves-only interface. I also bought a few packs of socks and underwear, a simulated leather jacket, a pair of boots, and a black knit wool cap to cover my freezing, stubble-covered noggin. I emerged from the store a few minutes later, dressed in my new Threads. As the frigid wind enveloped me again, I zipped up my new jacket and pulled on the wool cap. Much better. I tossed the maintenance tech jumpsuit and plastic indent shoes in a trash can. Then began to walk up High Street, scanning the storefronts. I kept my head down to avoid making eye contact with the stream of sullen university students filing past me. A few blocks later, I ducked into a Vendol franchise. Inside, there were rows of vending machines that sold everything under the sun. One of them, labeled Defense Dispenser, offered self-defense equipment, lightweight body armor, chemical repellents, and a wide selection of handguns. I tapped the screen set into the front of the machine and scrolled through the catalog. After a moment's deliberation, I purchased a flak vest and a Glock 47C pistol, along with 3 clips of ammo. I also bought a small canister of mace, then paid for everything by pressing my right palm to a hand scanner. My identity was verified and my criminal record was checked. Name, Wade Watts. Outstanding warrants, none. Credit rating, excellent. Purchase restrictions, none. Transaction, approved. Thank you for your business. I heard a heavy metallic thunk as my purchases slid into the steel tray near my knees. I pocketed the mace and put the flak vest on underneath my new shirt. Then I removed the Glock from its clear plastic blister packaging. This was the first time I'd ever held a real gun. Even so, the weapon felt familiar in my hands because I'd fired thousands of virtual firearms in the Oasis. I pressed a small button set into the barrel, and the gun emitted a tone. I held the pistol grip firmly for a few seconds, first in my right hand, then my left. The weapon emitted a second tone, letting me know it had finished scanning my handprints. I was now the only person who could fire it. The weapon had a built-in timer that would prevent it from firing for another 12 hours, a cooling-off period, but I still felt better having it on me. I walked to an Oasis parlor located a few blocks away, a franchise outlet called The Plug. The dingy backlit sign, which featured a smiling anthropomorphic fiber-optic cable, promised lightning-fast Oasis access, cheap gear rental, and private immersion bays, open 24/7, 365. I'd seen a lot of banner ads for The Plug online. They had a reputation for high prices and outdated hardware, but their connections were supposed to be fast, reliable, and lag-free. For me, their major selling point was that they were one of the few Oasis parlor chains not owned by IOI or one of its subsidiaries. The motion detector emitted a beep as I stepped through the front door. There was a small waiting area off to my right, currently empty. The carpet was stained and worn, and the whole place reeked of industrial-strength disinfectant. A vacant-eyed clerk glanced up at me from behind a bulletproof plexiglass barrier. He was in his early 20s, with a mohawk and dozens of facial piercings. He was wearing a bifocal visor, which gave him a semi-transparent view of the Oasis, while also allowing him to see his real-world surroundings. When he spoke, I saw that his teeth had all been sharpened to points. "Welcome to The Plug," he said in a flat monotone. "We have several bays free, so there's no waiting. Package pricing information is displayed right here." He pointed to the display screen mounted on the counter directly in front of me. Then his eyes glazed over as he refocused his attention on the world inside his visor. I scanned my choices. A dozen immersion rigs were available, of varying quality and price. Economy, standard, deluxe. I was given detailed specs on each. You could rent by the minute or pay a flat hourly rate. A visor and a pair of haptic gloves were included in the rental price, but a haptic suit cost extra. The rental contract contained a lot of fine print about the additional charges you would incur if you damaged the equipment and a lot of legalese stating that The Plug could not be held responsible for anything you did under any circumstances, especially if it was something illegal. "I'd like to rent one of the deluxe rigs for 12 hours," I said. The clerk raised his visor. "You have to pay in advance, you realize?" I nodded. "I also want to rent a fat pipe connection. I need to upload a large amount of data to my account." "Uploading costs extra. How much data?" 10 zettabytes. "Damn," he whispered. "What you uploading? The Library of Congress?" I ignored the question. "I also want the Mondo upgrade package," I said. "Sure thing," the clerk replied warily. "Your total comes to 11,000 big ones. Just put your thumb on the drum and we'll get you all fixed up." He looked more than a little surprised when the transaction cleared. Then he shrugged and handed me a key card, a visor, and some gloves.
Bay 14, last door on your right. The restroom is at the end of the hall. If you leave any kind of mess in the bay, we'll have to keep your deposit. Vomit, urine, semen, that kind of thing. And I'm the guy who has to clean it up. So do me a solid and show some restraint, will you? You got it. Enjoy. Thanks. Bay 14 was a soundproofed 10x10 room with a late model haptic rig in the center. I locked the door behind me and climbed into the rig. The vinyl on the haptic chair was worn and cracked. I slid the data drive into a slot on the front of the Oasis console and smiled as it locked into place. Max, I said to the empty air once I'd logged back in. This booted up a backup of Max that I kept stored in my Oasis account. Max's smiling face appeared on all of my command center monitors.
Hey there, compadre, he stuttered. How goes it?
Things are looking up, pal. Now strap in. We've got a lot of work to do. I opened up my Oasis account manager and initiated the upload from my flash drive. I paid GSS a monthly fee for unlimited data storage on my account, and I was about to test its limits. Even using the plug's high-bandwidth fiber-optic connection, the total estimated upload time for 10 zettabytes of data was over 3 hours. I reordered the upload sequence so the files I needed access to right away would get transferred first. As soon as data was uploaded to my Oasis account, I had immediate access to it and could also transfer it to other users instantaneously. First, I emailed all of the major news feeds a detailed account of how IOI had tried to kill me, how they had killed Daito, and how they were planning to kill Artemis and Shoto. I attached one of the video clips I'd retrieved from the Sixer database to the message, the video camera footage of Daito's execution. I also attached a copy of the memo Sorrento had sent to the IOI board, suggesting that they abduct Artemis and Shoto. Finally, I attached the SIM cap of my chat link session with Sorrento, but I bleeped the part where he said my real name and blurred the image of my school photo. I wasn't yet ready to reveal my true identity to the world. I planned to release the unedited video later, once the rest of my plan had played out. Then it wouldn't matter. I spent about 15 minutes composing one last email, which I addressed to every single Oasis user. Once I was happy with the wording, I stored it in my drafts folder. Then, I logged into H's basement. When my avatar appeared inside the chat room, I saw that H, Artemis, and Shoto were already there, waiting for me.
Chapter 32. Z! H shouted as my avatar appeared. What the hell, man? Where have you been? I've been trying to reach you for over a week.
So have I, Shoto added. Where were you, and how did you get those files from the Sixer database?
It's a long story, I said. First things first. I addressed Shoto and Artemis. Have you two left your homes? They both nodded. And you're each logged in from a safe location?
Yes, Shoto said. I'm in a manga cafe right now.
And I'm at the Vancouver airport, Artemis said. It was the first time I'd heard her voice in months.
I'm logged in from a germ-ridden public Oasis booth right now. I ran out of my house with nothing but the clothes on my back, so I hope that Sixer data you sent us is legit.
It is, I said. Trust me.
How can you be sure of that? Shoto asked.
Because I hacked into the Sixer database and downloaded it myself.
They all stared at me in silence. H raised an eyebrow. And how, exactly, did you manage that, Z?
I assumed a fake identity and masqueraded as an indentured servant to infiltrate IOI's corporate headquarters. I've been there for the past 8 days. I just now escaped.
Holy shit, Shoto whispered. Seriously?
I nodded. Dude, you have balls of solid adamantium, H said. Respect.
Thanks, I think. Let's assume you're not totally bullshitting us, Artemis said. How does a lowly indent get access to secret Sixer dossier files and company memos?
I turned to face her.
Indents have limited access to the company intranet via their HAB unit entertainment system from behind the IOI firewall. From there, I was able to use a series of backdoors and system exploits left by the original programmers to tunnel through the network and hack directly into the Sixers' private database. Shoto looked at me in awe.
You did that? All by yourself?
That is correct, sir.
It's a miracle they didn't catch you and kill you, Artemis said. Why would you take such a stupid risk?
Why do you think? To try and find a way to get through their shield and reach the third gate.
I shrugged. It was the only plan I could come up with on such short notice.
Z, H said, grinning. You are one crazy son of a bitch. He walked over and gave me a high five. But that's why I love you, man.
Artemis scowled at me.
Of course, when you found out they had secret files on each of us, you just couldn't resist looking at them, could you?
I had to look at them, I said, to find out how much they knew about each of us. You would have done the same thing.
She leveled a finger at me. No, I wouldn't have. I respect other people's privacy.
Artemis, chill out, H interjected. He probably saved your life, you know.
She seemed to consider this. Fine, she said. Forget it. But I could tell she was still pissed off. I didn't know what to say, so I kept plowing forward. I'm sending each of you a copy of all the Sixer data I smuggled out, 10 zettabytes of it. You should have it now. I waited while each of them checked their inbox. The size of their database on Halliday is unreal. His whole life is in there. They've collected interviews with everyone Halliday ever knew. It could take months to read through them all. I waited for a few minutes, watching their eyes scan over the data.
Whoa, Shoto said. This is incredible.
He looked over at me.
How the hell did you escape from IOI with all of this stuff?
By being extra sneaky. H is right, Artemis said, shaking her head. You are certifiably nuts. She hesitated for a second, then added, Thanks for the warning, Z. I owe you one. I opened my mouth to say you're welcome, but no words came out.
Yes, Shoto said. So do I. Thanks.
Don't mention it, guys, I finally managed to say. Well, H said, hit us with the bad news already. How close are the Sixers to clearing the third gate?
Dig this, I said, grinning. They haven't even figured out how to open it yet.
Artemis and Shoto stared at me in disbelief. H smiled wide, then began to bob his head and press his palms to the sky, as if dancing to some unheard rave track.
Oh yes! Oh yes! He sang.
You're kidding, right? Shoto asked. I shook my head.
You're not kidding? Artemis said. How is that possible?
Sorrento has the crystal key, and he knows where the gate is. All he has to do is open the damn thing and step inside, right?
That was true for the first two gates, I replied. But gate three is different.
I opened a large vidfeed window in the air beside me. Check this out. It's from the Sixers video archive. It's a vidcap of their first attempt to open the gate. I hit play. The video clip opened with a shot of Sorrento's avatar standing outside the front gates of Castle Anorak. The castle's front entrance, which had been impregnable for so many years, swung open as Sorrento approached, like an automatic door at a supermarket. The castle entrance will open for an avatar who holds a copy of the crystal key, I explained. If an avatar doesn't have a copy of the key, he can't cross the threshold and enter the castle, even if the doors are already open. We all watched the vidcap as Sorrento passed through the entrance and into the large gold-lined foyer that lay beyond. Sorrento's avatar crossed the polished floor and approached the large crystal door set into the north wall. There was a keyhole in the very center of the door, and directly above it, three words were etched into the door's glittering, faceted surface. Charity, hope, faith. Sorrento stepped forward, holding out his copy of the crystal key. He slid the key into the keyhole and turned it. Nothing happened. Sorrento glanced up at the three words printed on the gate. Charity, hope, faith, he said, reading them aloud. Once again, nothing happened. Sorrento removed the key, recited the three words again, then reinserted the key and turned it. Still, nothing. I studied H, Artemis, and Shoto as they watched the video. Their excitement and curiosity had already shifted into concentration as they attempted to solve the puzzle before them. I paused the video. Whenever Sorrento is logged in, he has a team of consultants and researchers watching his every move, I said. You can hear their voices on some of the vidcaps, feeding him suggestions and advice through his comlink. So far, they haven't been much help. Watch. On the video, Sorrento was making another attempt to open the gate. He did everything exactly as before, except this time, when he inserted the crystal key, he turned it counterclockwise instead of clockwise. They try every asinine thing you can imagine, I said. Sorrento recites the words on the gate in Latin, and Elvish, and Klingon. Then they get hung up on reciting 1 Corinthians 13:13, a Bible verse that contains the words charity, hope, and faith. Apparently, charity, hope, and faith are also the names of three martyred Catholic saints. The Sixers have been trying to attach some significance to that for the past few days. Morons, H said. Halliday was an atheist. They're getting desperate now, I said. Sorrento has tried everything but genuflecting, doing a little dance, and sticking his pinky finger in the keyhole. That's probably next up on his agenda, Shoto said, grinning. Charity, hope, faith, Artemis said, reciting the words slowly. She turned to me. Where do I know that from? Yeah, H said. Those words do sound familiar. It took me a while to place them too, I said. They all looked at me expectantly. Say them in reverse order, I suggested. Better yet, sing them in reverse order. Artemis's eyes narrowed. Faith, hope, charity, she said. She repeated them a few times, recognition growing in her face. Then she sang, faith and hope and charity. H picked up the next line. The heart and the brain and the body. Give you three as a magic number, Shoto finished triumphantly. Schoolhouse rock, they all shouted in unison. See, I said. I knew you guys would get it. You're a smart bunch. Three is a magic number. Music and lyrics by Bob Doro, Artemis recited, as if pulling the information from a mental encyclopedia. Written in 1973. I smiled at her. I have a theory. I think this might be Halliday's way of telling us how many keys are required to open the third gate. Artemis grinned, then sang, it takes three. No more, no less, continued Shoto. You don't have to guess, added H. Three, I finished, is the magic number. I took out my own copy of the crystal key and held it up. The others did the same. We have four copies of the key. If at least three of us can reach the gate, we can get it open. What then? H asked. Do we all enter the gate at the same time? What if only one of us can enter the gate once it's open? Artemis said. I doubt Halliday would have set it up like that, I said. Who knows what that crazy bastard was thinking, Artemis said. He's toyed with us every step of the way, and now he's doing it again. Why else would he require three copies of the crystal key to open the final gate? Maybe because he wanted to force us to work together, I suggested. Or he just wanted the contest to end with a big dramatic finale, H offered. Think about it. If three avatars enter the third gate at the exact same moment, then it becomes a race to see who can clear the gate and reach the egg first. Halliday was one crazy, sadistic bastard, Artemis muttered. Yeah, H said, nodding. You got that right. Look at it this way, Shoto said. If Halliday hadn't set up the third gate to require three keys,
The Sixers might have already found the egg by now.
But the Sixers have a dozen avatars with copies of the crystal key, H said. They could open the gate right now if they were smart enough to figure out how.
Dilettantes, Artemis said. It's their own fault for not knowing all the Schoolhouse Rock lyrics by heart. How did those fools even get this far?
By cheating, I said. Remember?
Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting.
She grinned at me, and I felt my knees go all rubbery.
Just because the Sixers haven't opened the gate yet doesn't mean they won't figure it out eventually, Shoto said.
I nodded. Shoto's right. Sooner or later, they'll make the Schoolhouse Rock connection, so we can't waste any more time.
Well, what are we waiting for? Shoto said excitedly. We know where the gate is and how to open it. So let's do it, and may the best Gunter win.
You're forgetting something, Shota-san, H said. Parzival here still hasn't told us how we're going to get past that shield, fight our way through the Sixers' army, and get inside the castle. He turned to me.
You do have a plan for that, don't you, Z?
Of course, I said. I was just getting to that. I made a sweeping gesture with my right hand, and a three-dimensional hologram of Castle Anorak appeared, floating in the air in front of me. The transparent blue sphere generated by the orb of Ozuvox appeared around the castle, surrounding it both above and below ground. I pointed to it. This shield is going to drop on its own at noon on Monday, about 36 hours from now. And then we're going to walk right through the castle's front entrance.
The shield is going to drop?
On its own? Artemis repeated.
The clans have been lobbing nukes at that sphere for the past 2 weeks, and they haven't even scratched it. How are you going to get it to drop on its own?
I've already taken care of it, I said. You guys are going to have to trust me.
I trust you, Z, H said. But even if that shield does drop, to reach the castle, we'll still have to fight our way through the largest army in the oasis.
He pointed to the hologram, which showed the Sixer troop positions around the castle, just inside the sphere.
What about these fools? And their tanks? And their gunships?
Obviously, we're going to need a little help, I said.
A lot of help, Artemis clarified. And who exactly are we going to convince to help us wage war against the entire Sixer army? H asked.
Everyone, I said. Every single Gunter on the grid. I opened another window, displaying the brief email I'd composed just before logging into the basement. I'm going to send this message out tonight to every single Oasis user. Fellow Gunters, it is a dark day. After years of deception, exploitation, and knavery, the Sixers have finally managed to buy and cheat their way to the entrance of the third gate. As you know, IOI has barricaded Castle Anorak in an attempt to prevent anyone else from reaching the egg. We've also learned that they've used illegal methods to uncover the identities of Gunters they consider a threat, with the intention of abducting and murdering them. If Gunters around the world don't join forces to stop the Sixers, they will reach the egg and win the contest. And then the Oasis will fall under IOI's imperialist rule. The time is now. Our assault on the Sixer army will begin tomorrow at noon, OST. Join us. Sincerely, H, Artemis, Parzival, and Shoto.
Knavery? Artemis said after she'd finished reading it.
Were you using a thesaurus when you wrote this?
I was trying to make it sound, you know, grand, I said. Official.
Me likey, Z, H said. It really gets the blood stirring.
Thanks, H.
So that's it. This is your plan, Artemis said. Spam the entire Oasis asking for help?
More or less, yeah, that's the plan.
And you really think everyone will just show up and help us fight the Sixers, she said, just for the hell of it.
Yes, I said, I do.
H nodded. He's right. No one wants the Sixers to win the contest, and they definitely don't want IOI to take control of the Oasis.
people will jump at a chance to help bring the Sixers down. And what Gunter is going to pass up a chance to fight in such an epic, history-making battle?
But won't the clans think we're just trying to manipulate them, Shoto said, so that we can reach the gate ourselves?
Of course, I said, but most of them have already given up. Everyone knows the end of the hunt is at hand. Don't you think most people would rather see one of us win the contest instead of Sorrento and the Sixers?
Artemis considered it for a moment.